listening to It's Confirmed with Tomiko Torres, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome back, guys. Welcome back. Lots of people have joined in to the show, starting off with, wow, 3.9 million people have logged on to hear this episode today. Very nice. Glad you all could join me this evening. We have a guy coming on today. Remember we talked about Elie Wiinstein, a.k.a., you know, they gave him this name, Mike Koenig, or whatever his name's supposed to be, Mikey, he goes for anything. Well, we're back with that again today. And guess what? Jeff was on the line with us last week, and they, you know, Jeff had a lot to say. You know, Jeff is alleging he was also a business partner. He is alleging that he also had contacts with the people involved, you know, real people, real deals. And basically, we want to talk about today some of the legalities with the losses and the commutation of Mr. Wiinstein's sentence. There's some questions that came up, and I'm hoping this gentleman by the name of Brian, who is very familiar with this case, he can answer some of the questions that you guys have had for the past two shows. I know you guys were very concerned about some things concerning the attorney that was involved. You know, was it a setup on their end? And how this all plays out for Mr. Wiinstein, who was sentenced to 37 years in federal prison. Amongst that, he was in violation of his supervised release by conducting ghost transactions, according to the government. And these are some of the things that we're going to get a little bit of clarity on today. Speaking of ghost transactions, I don't know if anybody is aware, but usually when it comes to the SEC, I don't know how many ghosts can actually survive being a part of those transactions, because there is a chain of command that people must follow, such as, you know, who's in charge, broker dealers, the actual firm, who holds the weight for some of the money that comes in. And we'll get to that today as well. But, you know, it all started back when Mr. Wiinstein started his supervision. You know, he got out of prison, sentence commutated by President Trump, and he had supervised conditions to uphold and to live by. And we discussed that. I know some people had some concerns about that because they wanted to know, well, if the guy couldn't even use a borrowed piece of tissue to blow his nose, what was he able to do independently as being, you know, a provider for his household? So these are some of the things that we're going to get down to the bottom to today. Also, the amount of the calculated loss, we're going to talk about those losses today, because you remember Mr. Wiinstein had other losses, over $200 million at one point in another case. This case, another $44 million. And, you know, monies need to be accounted for. So I'm not sure if anyone is aware how this particular layer system of authority works, but we're going to get into that as well. We're going to talk about some things with cooperators, co-conspirators, attorneys that became business partners in the latter part of the transactions to save their own skin. And we're going to talk about co-conspirators that never showed up for trial. We're going to even talk about some of the people that made allegations that he, in fact, you know, he did business with. And these people now have become ghosts to the government. So we're not sure if it's actually ghost or these people were actually told to stay away from this trial. So that's something that behoovers the mind to thinking that, you know, was this guy framed? Was it real deals? Was it fake deals? Was it deals that was set up by the, I don't want to say this because it sounds kind of weird, but was it deals set up by the government to make sure that Mr. Weinstein stayed in prison for all of his dirty deeds, according to them, that he did in the past. And for some people, what they don't realize is in business, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And unfortunately, it happens every day. I know you guys remember the Martha Stewart case where she got like an insider that told her, listen, the stock is about to drop. You need to pull out. She actually kept all of her funds and everybody else took a great loss. You know, Tesla loses stock, Ford, all these big companies, people lose money every single day. So you can invest today, but you don't know what tomorrow may hold. And, you know, sometimes people feel as though, okay, I have equity in my home. I'm going to invest it and let's see what happens. One of the biggest scandals out there today is reverse mortgages. Reverse mortgages are some of the biggest scams ever. They target the elderly. They have all these fees that are enormous. And by the time the person dies and the heirs look to get the property back, they owe from the no mortgage, they owe maybe $600,000-$700,000 on the home. And the family cannot afford to buy it because the appraisal doesn't even come in that high. And then the house needs a substantial amount of work, whereas the actual reverse lender is supposed to maintain the home during their time of owning it as well. So there's a lot of things that is risky business here today, you know, and unfortunately for people that take their life savings or people that don't take their life savings, which we're going to get into that a little bit as well, to just bring to the light of real and fake. So when we talk about real transactions, we talk about people being registered brokers. Now, registered brokers, they have a fiduciary duty to deal with accredited and unaccredited clients. And there is the amount of money that they would take and say, we're going to invest this money for this client. And it has to go to a certain limit. There's limits to everything. You know, there's no, you know, it's free willy. It's a pond of gold out there. There's no such thing. So if someone comes to you and say, you know, as a registered agent, and they have like, you know, a deal and they say, listen, I got a great deal. You're my client. You're an unaccredited investor. We're going to invest your life savings into this deal. And you don't know if it's a real deal or not. How do you actually know if the deal is real or not? Because they have firms. The actual firm that is licensed with the SEC, they have the full responsibility to make sure that your money, your investment is protected. And we're going to get into that a little bit as well. And I, you know, it's just mighty strange that a lot of times with people, they actually have, you know, a couple of things that goes on with them, you know. And I'd like to give a special shout out to our sponsors today. You know, they support our show and they're glad to be a part of our show as well. And I'll tell you this much, guys, it's a lot of people out here today living with mental trauma and mental illness. And sometimes in life, you don't need a solution. You just need someone to listen. And the reality is those moments don't wait for appointments or schedules. They happen in real time. That's exactly what OpenLine is, and that's why it was created. OpenLine is a new app that allows you to connect instantly with a real person, someone who's there, who will listen, who understands that sometimes having a conversation can make all the difference. There's no pressure, no judgment, no complicated process. You can just simply go on the app, openlinenow.com, and you can find it on the App Store or Google Play. Open line, because no one should have to go through a difficult moment alone. I think this open line is a really great thing. I actually signed up myself, guys, because I wanted to have you know, an open line of communication with someone that may be in need. And you don't have to worry. It's not therapy. It's a human connection. And that is what sometimes people are missing in life. So when you do have the chance, please go on to openlinenow.com. Mental trauma exists in many households today. And particularly with Elie Wiinstein, I can only imagine the trauma that his family is experiencing of having all of these things said about him, you know, from, you know, the part of him being a car salesman. Here it is. He's a businessman. He's wasn't just an ordinary car salesman. This guy owned dealerships. You know, he had a real business going on. He had a lot of money too, as well. He made a lot of money. He worked hard. He was not, you know, as they say in the Jewish community, he wasn't just schlepping around. He was making things happen. He was making things happen, not just for himself, but for his friends as well. So these are some of the things we have to keep in mind when we make harsh statements. Like the young lady, Jessica, that sent the message to me from last week's show. And she said that, unfortunately, Mr. Wiinstein was railroaded. He was derailed. His train was derailed. This is what she said. And when you come up with the facts of certain things, this is what it all boils down to at the end. And by the way, Mr. Wiinstein had his fate follow him for his supervised release violation. And unfortunately, guys, from what I'm being told, his attorney, you know, that represented him did a very poor job, refused to prove the facts, refused to show, you know, evidence of, did he violate his supervised release or did he have new conditions that were imposed without proper justification, or did it even exist at sentencing? You know, for people that wanted to give him new modified conditions. By the way, I also had an insider tell me that his original probation officer actually never showed up. I was told there was a new guy that showed up and never seen Mr. Wiinstein a day in his life. So this is something that rings bells and has ears open. People want to know the truth about some things. You know, if it was your original person, why wouldn't your original person, even though he testified at trial, the original guy, what would be the secret in hiding this, you know, guy that says, hey, he violated, and judge, we're here to nail him to the cross? From what I was told, and, you know, I had to confirm it, is that this new probation had no idea who Mr. Wiinstein was at all. Didn't even know him, never had even seen him. So I'm not sure how that operation runs. But what I can tell you is some of these things that happened to Mr. Wiinstein doesn't only happen to Mr. Wiinstein. You know, before people would say that it was, you know, a racial tactic, but it happens to all nationalities. It doesn't even matter what race, religion, color, anything, whatever you are. It can happen to anyone. And it's so important to have people on your team, on your legal team, that can justify some of the things that the judicial system put in place to either, one, harm you, or two, harm you again. So, you know, there is no real justice because you have too many game players. And some of the game players want to see you fry in the frying pan like bacon on a Sunday morning. So, you know, you're just cooking in grease right now. That's basically what's happening. And you got to say thank you to his legal team for basically, and I'll give you an example, and then you can say thank you. You ever seen, go to like the chicken houses where they actually kill the chickens and they torture them and they put them in the hot water so all the, you know, the feathers could come off? This is what Mr. Wiinstein is going through. They actually have him in the hot water right now, and they want to see his skin. They want him to lose his hair. you know, this is what's going on with him today. And it's kind of shameful that he would have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to think that he has someone on his team, you know, paying an attorney, trusting the attorney. Guy's all beat up and battered right now. He's like a battered husband, you know, a battered spouse, where anything that someone tells him, you know, it's like he's being abused, and he doesn't know who to trust in this whole process. But the crazy part about it is, when you have friends that are a part of the judicial system and they can guide you and they can lead you and they can say, guess what? These are some of the things that someone did to you that were not ethically correct. And, you know, those people sometimes are your good friends. And it all depends on how much do they know about the judicial system? What do they know that will help you now get out of the bind that you're in, that your attorneys, for profit or not for profit, basically put you in? It's a play to pay game. That's what it is. And if you don't have the pay, you will get played. And that's it, because people are out here to line their pockets and make sure that they are the winners. You know, I just feel like in his case, maybe he should have went with just a pro bono attorney, or, you know, as they call them, which I'm not in favor of the saying, but public pretenders, because they pretend that they're working for you when in fact they're not. But some of them do work for you. And some of them, you know, they get on your team and they want to see that, you know, you see justice and there's daylight at the end. So, you know, we all have to see in the end who is really there for us or not. And that is a double-edged sword sometimes, you know, especially with Mr. Weinstein not taking the stand in his own trial to have a voice for himself, where his attorneys basically told him, you know, sit down, be quiet, and don't speak. And I get it, because sometimes you don't want your client to say certain things. We call that in the judicial system opening the back door. You don't want to open the back door, because if you open the back door, you may not be able to close it. So these are some of the things that could come up, you know, when a defendant takes the stand. I'm actually waiting for this gentleman, Brian, to come on so he can add some clarity to some of the questions that you guys have. One question someone just sent across is, when was his sentence commutated? That was in January of 2021. I don't know what significance that would have to Mr. Weinstein at this point today, but I'll open up the air for questions. But hang on just a second. Brian is here.
Tomiko, hi. Hey. And thank you so much for including me in the show. I'm grateful for having the opportunity to provide my independent insights on this very important topic. Unfortunate, I believe, as I believe you do, targeting of an individual for unfair prosecution.
Oh, so glad that you're here, Brian, because people were just starting to line up with questions and I got kind of stuck for a second there. I wanted to ask you, what do you know about the commutation for Mr. Weinstein?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, because I see the commutation of his original combined sentences back in 2011 as the beginning of the story that we're seeing unfold right now, and the trial and the sentencing that just occurred, resulting in, you know, cumulatively 38 years. But as I've said to you before, for a 50-year-old man, I colloquially would call that a life sentence. So when Eli was commuted, an enormous privilege by President Trump in January of 2021, it wasn't relationship based. It wasn't money based. It was based on a very well-researched document by the now deceased Nancy Gertner in a technical document that was an appeal that the government calls a 2255, a section 2255, in which she uncovered after the fact quite a bit of misconduct in the handling of his original case. And while that 2255 submission, while Eli had been in federal prison for upwards of six or seven years at this point, was never adjudicated through the court system, the findings that Nancy published in this fascinating article, which anyone who's curious about the case, I would really encourage to take back in time and read through it thoroughly. It was an amazing read for me that opened my eyes and really eliminated quite a bit of the skepticism that I came into this with based on what was in the public domain. That 2255 informed the office, the pardon office, to issue the commutation. And then the 2255 was pulled because it was no longer necessary because Mr. Weinstein was granted what we'll refer to as a get out of free jail free card. Now, commutations are very interesting versus full pardons because they're partial. They are, as I said, get out of jail free cards. They don't pardon you and eliminate the entirety of your sentencing. And they can be bespoke in nature, which is to say that there are general ones that just say you go home and everything else, you know, and that's it. The process follows. But there can be specific terms added to those commutations that say, not only do I order the release of this inmate, but I also am enforcing that other terms of his sentence remain intact. And this is a critical constitutional Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution debate over government authority and whether or not a change in his supervised release. And for those that aren't familiar with federal nomenclature, it's call it parole or probation. It's the folks that supervise you for a period of time where you re-enter society and they want to make sure you're following the rules. And those are very well documented. So in that process, there is an open question as to the legality of the changes that they made to Mr. Weinstein's conditions after his release, which put in provisions that, in my personal opinion, reading it independently, precluded him from being able to provide for his family while still being subject to approximately $250 million in restitution payments. And it was that formed the environment, so to speak, for which it was highly likely that he would be put into a forced error position. And that, you know, we can pick up from there, but that formed the genesis of this case.
Well, let me ask you, why would that matter at this day and time? He's been sentenced to 37 years. Why would that matter at this point?
So here's the trouble that I see in it from there's always the fairness perspective, and then there's the legal perspective. And from a fairness perspective, if we sit here now and analyze it and prove that the authority didn't exist at the time to make the change, and just to speak of my credentials and, not overstate, my knowledge of the law, I am not a licensed attorney. I work in a pro bono capacity in my retirement, protecting civil rights as a paralegal expert Forensic analysis, and it's just a passion of mine to help people that have been unfairly prosecuted by the system, typically those of lower socioeconomic means than Mr. Weinstein. But given the sentences that have compounded, you could very easily argue he is of low socioeconomic means. You can never pay back $250 million and now I guess $300 million in restitution. So mine is based on a deep interest in equality and independent study of the law. But I do have quite a bit of experience in the courtroom, in a pro bono capacity. So with that being said, I think that there's a very interesting constitutional analysis. However, the issue that I believe we're going to have as we pursue, means of clemency here, either through the legal appellate process or through an attempt at a second commutation, which seems like being struck by lightning twice or perhaps winning the lottery twice, is that the natural response would be if you had then an argument of the constitutionality and the authority of the judge or other entities involved to have made that change, that you should have argued it back in 2021, which is a very unfortunate case, right? And I'm sympathetic personally to the Weinstein family after Mr. Weinstein sat in terrible. There's a lot of detail of this case, but he was punished severely by this judge and put into some of the worst federal prisons in the United States under incredible supervision criteria. In fact, he was in the same facility for a while as El Chapo.
I have a question that came in from a gentleman, Wilson Stafford, sure, wants to know, why wouldn't his legal team raise these concerns?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would it take a person such as yourself to raise these concerns on Mr. Weinstein's behalf after he's been sentenced to 37 years?
While I respect the legal profession, I've got a few different answers to that. One is what I'll call a sugar high. Imagine that your husband, your father, your client has been in federal prison under the most extreme and punishing, and when I say extreme and punishing, the details of his isolation will bring a tear to your eye. And anyone who hasn't been incarcerated couldn't even relate to this man who had an incredibly successful life, and his background was modest, right? He was self-made, and his story, and maybe that's for another show, of how he made himself is so stunning and so inspirational that itself should be told. But you now get this gift of just as President Trump is leaving office in January of 21, you get a gift of a get out of jail free card. And the sugar high, for lack of a better framing, and appreciation, you're just so happy to have to be home, to be out of that environment, for the ordeal to be over, for his family to have, and he has, a beautiful, caring family, a loving family, very, very beautiful. I think you take your eye off the ball a little bit, and you're just so willing to not challenge or take on the system because you're afraid. You're afraid to ruffle feathers and for something, this great gift, to be rescinded in some way. Now, that's on the family point. The legal point could be similar, which is, I don't know that we should argue this right now, just given, the nature of how this came to be. And let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. I don't know. I wasn't involved at that point. This is, you know, me going back and studying it as one of the most interesting cases that I'm in some way involved with. But it could be that, or it could be that they simply didn't consider the absolute authority that a president has under Article 2 that cannot be undone. But it's also very important to know the specific language that was included in the commutation.
And right. And these attorneys that he had representing him, they would have had this information, correct?
They would have absolutely had President Trump's signed warrant, they called it, with the specific terms of his release. And it would have been additionally an exhibit in the hearing approximately a month later that adjusted and altered in a very targeted way the terms of his supervised release, eliminating his primary skill set and ability to earn a living for his family, and furthermore, to repay restitution to the alleged victims of the crime he was convicted for. So that altercation post hoc, after the fact, is highly questionable from a process perspective. It supports the optics of somebody that would argue that he was targeted and put in a position to almost certainly be accused of reoffending in the future.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's talk about the losses. It's calculated somewhere at $44 million.
Right.
So who's did he receive this money? How did he get, you know, accused of $44 million? Like, where did this come from?
Yeah. So the base of the charge against him was tied back to this supervised release provision that we just discussed.
No. So, hold on, Brian.
Yeah.
We're talking about $44 million. That means someone gave you some money, meaning Mr. Weinstein, $44 million and said, here's my $44 million. I need you to invest it for me. Yep. And that never happened. So did someone come to Mr. Weinstein and say, here's the $44 million?
The entire business venture with his co-defendants was something that they approached him about, not vice versa. He did not mastermind a scheme where he enlisted, unsophisticated participants. This was highly experienced, accredited investors that asked him to be involved.
But what made them accredited investors? Who knew that these investors were accredited?
So
who knew that part?
That's a great question. I'm going off of their credentials and their history as I know it from reading through the public case documents. But these are real estate investors. They've, you know, participated in other businesses. And, you know, in this particular case, some of those businesses, unfortunately, were not lawful businesses, and complicates the case a little bit further. But I want to make this point very clearly. At no point did Mr. Weinstein ever have control over movements of money.
Oh, well, that's kind of strange, because they said that he had a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And he took monies from over in his trial transcripts, over 200 victims. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Usually with this amount of people and such a high loss, there was two people that were like hedge fund dealers or brokers or registered agents, or brokers with a firm. Right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Richard Curry and Chris Anderson.
Okay, so being as though they were registered with the firm, right?
Mm-hmm.
wouldn't the firm have to have supervision over monies coming in? And I'll say this, because usually on their, you know, their firm profile, they have their, you know, their CRD number, they have the SEC number, they have their mailing address location. Mm-hmm. They have something that's called RBC Correspondent Services. Mm-hmm. They have RBC Advisor Services.
Determinations of accredited investor status. It's very, very controlled.
So it's very controlled. So if Richard Curry and Christopher Anderson worked for this entity, which is the firm, right?
Mm-hmm. They were the co-founders and only two employees. It was their 50-50 firm.
Well, this is what I think people are missing the big picture of. The actual firm that was in control of Richard Curry and Chris Anderson's corporation.
Yes.
Because they were like a sub corporation up under the big guy. So the big guy, they actually were supposed to have what's called a compliance manager, chief mm-hmm. compliance officer, excuse me.
Yep.
And they're also supposed to have a chief risk officer.
Yeah, FINRA regulated, etc.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. with all of this control, and also they have general counsel as well, mm-hmm. and they have presidents and vice presidents. They have principal operation officers. They have a whole slew of people, you know, controlling things for this mm-hmm. organization.
Highly regulated FINRA and SEC registered.
Absolutely. So I'm trying to figure out this part with the losses. So being as though Mr. Weinstein is not a licensed investment advisor, and he's not a registered agent, how would it be possible for him to even accept investments? Oh, I think I lost my guy. It's just starting to get good, guys. Let's see if he calls back in. But I'll let you guys know this. It's not even... he's back. Okay,
yeah,
great.
So I'm sorry, I'm putting my phone in do not disturb. Somebody called and it forced the disconnect. My apologies. Hopefully we can avoid that going forward.
Yes. So Brian, this is what I was trying to come to here. How is it possible? Because when you have such a big firm that's controlled by FINRA, right? Mm-hmm. How is it possible for Mr. Weinstein to have 200 clients? He's not a part of the firm. He's not registered anywhere, but Christopher Anderson and Richard Curry is. So how That's could right. these clients be Mr. Weinstein's clients that he defrauded?
So that I'm glad you asked that question, because this is one of the key components, putting aside the history and incentives for people to pursue Mr. Weinstein. If we look at this case in isolation, there is no mention in any, and I did participate in person sitting in the trial as much as I could. I did not sit in every hearing, but I have read thoroughly the transcripts and every public document that I could. So, I there's a lot of under seal information in this case. And for the listeners, under seal means unless you're an attorney working on that case, you're not allowed to see it. And that alone is highly suspicious to me, because this should really be fully documented for us, the public, and in particular, Tomiko, people like you and I who are so interested in supporting the rights, the civil rights of various people, and fighting on their behalf when they can't, we should have access to those records. There is nothing published that I have seen about a registered broker-dealer, FINRA registration, but I do know from those transcripts and my participation that Richard and Chris formed Trion after approaching Mr. Weinstein, asking to be more involved, such that their goal of creating this business was to raise capital from their friends and family, which you refer to as the 200 people, and pool that money together into into a larger loan from Trion itself, right? Pooled capital and lend that out to another entity called Optimus. Mr. Weinstein had no knowledge of access to transparency into who these people were, what the term sheets of those investment propositions looked like. And what's interesting, what came out is that these were personally guaranteed investments where Mr. Curry put his own assets behind as collateral, guaranteed repayment of the loans. So these, Mr. Weinstein couldn't have, under that structure, defrauded people he has never spoken to, communicated with. The advertising of the business opportunities was done by the Trion principals, Richard and Chris. So,
because I'm a little confused, because usually if you have an offering, let's say I want Brian to buy into my product, I would have to create a memorandum of offering.
Yes.
And it would have to be reviewed and they would have to vet it out. And then they would have to put it on their list of investments after the proper due diligence is being had. So I would like to find out, where was the actual offering? I mean, Mr. Weinstein offered something for sale and they said that he created a Ponzi scheme. Shouldn't there be like a copy of an offering somewhere?
So those documents were included in the discovery and they were introduced and shown in part to the jury during the trial as exemplars of, you know, the broader, obviously you're not going to show them 200. And it was Mr. Curry and Mr. Anderson who were advertising what the offering was. Okay. It wasn't Mr. Weinstein. They were creating the narrative of those deals. So what they were doing was accumulating these $35, $45 million in assets that they then pooled, and they created general purpose loans to another entity, which Mr. Weinstein was also not directly affiliated with, that directed the money flow. And this is critical when you get to the, and there is this interesting federal law nuance in punishment determinations. It's very different from state and municipal and the stuff that traffic tickets and, you know, the crimes that we're all more familiar with. The federal system works in a much more complex way. So the scope of your punishment is in a financial crime, mostly determined by the amount of loss. But that's not an issue for trial and determination of guilt. That's an issue that they reserve for sentencing, where there is no jury, and it is up to the judge to decide what the loss was. Now, what's interesting here, and you know, I'm sure we're going to circle back to, Mr. Weinstein did, in fact, repay those loans, but he did so by transferring physical assets that instead of cash, right? So those assets were of significant value. They were accepted by the Trion principals, who were the ones that were making the loans. The lenders are a second level deep into this, right? They are underneath the Trion principals. So they, Mr. Weinstein repaid more than the cash amount that you could, someone may argue he had some indirect control over. And that's where I really am focused on in this case, that he was given no credit for his good faith, mutually agreed return of these highly valuable assets to the partners of Trion, who were the fiduciaries responsible for making decisions on behalf of their 200 clients. So for Mr. Weinstein to have been charged, portrayed or otherwise as having defrauded those investors is missing an entire layer of indirection, which is Richard and Chris's participation. And it's so apparent as I read through it that I struggle with how that determination was honestly reached. And for that reason, he was given no credit for that offset. And to put this into magnitude, that repayment of assets is the difference between the rest of your life in prison versus maybe 3 to 5 years. Not to say that that's an easy bid either. But that is such a critical point that I wholeheartedly disagree with based on the structures you're talking about, the fiduciary responsibilities, my own background prior to retiring and taking on this heavy interest in civil rights, which comes from hedge funds, asset management firms, private equity, et cetera. I'm very familiar with what you're talking about. So I struggle to ascribe the blame to Mr. Weinstein. And right. I believe he acted in good faith. And from, reading certain materials, getting to know him, interviewing people, I believe over a long period of time, he acted highly ethically and in good faith to attempt to help the Trion partners who were in what we would call a liquidity crunch. They accepted illiquid assets, right? So let's just say, you owned a castle in Ireland and and someone gave you that instead of $10 million. You can't Brian, sell it in a day to repay.
And Brian, I'm going to stop you there because we're coming to a close, but for sure, we would like to circle back with you to talk about these losses and who controlled mm-hmm. them. Would it be okay if we invite you back to the show?
I would. I am thinking about this case every day. It would be my pleasure to come back on the show on this. It would also be my pleasure to come back on other civil rights matters, in particular those related to lower socioeconomic groups that don't have the resources to fight these types of battles. I am surgically focused in my second part of my life on fighting for those that can't fight for themselves. So
I thank you so very much, Brian, for coming on today, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the participation, and I appreciate the forum to help advocate for Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Brian, and have a wonderful day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. Guys, did you hear that? He has a lot to say. There's a lot of scammers. You got a guy being scammed by scammers. Well, didn't come out of my mouth, but it did come out of his. A scammer being scammed. I guess no risk, no reward. Well, guys, thank you for joining me today. We have 19.30 million listeners on today. Guys, you guys want to hear this gossip. I love it. I love it. See you next week. Same bat place, same bat time. Tommy Torres signing off. Bye now.
You're listening to It's Confirmed with Tomiko Torres, only on LA Talk Radio.